Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Off The Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. I hope you're all doing well today. Today's episode, well, it's a cracker. It's with somebody that I grew up watching their band, and their band was something that I'd never experienced a live event like it. It was sinister, it was intense, it was unnerving. It involved the front man firing blanks at the audience, and it, just the whole package that come with being a fan of this band was something exciting and as mentioned, unnerving. And that band was Sheep on Drugs. I stumbled across on Instagram about a month or so ago, and was excited to see that they were playing shows, and so I reached out to them and spoke to today's guest, which is Dead Lee, Lee Fraser of Sheep on Drugs, and it was an opportunity to sort of find out the story behind this band and how it came to fruition, and how it got to where it's currently at as well, and he's a fascinating and he was an absolute gentleman as well. So before we start this episode, just a shout out to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network, and I would also like to thank 76 for producing this podcast. And if you like this podcast, please go and have a look in the back catalogue. You will see episodes with, blimey, Mark Moore from S Express, Adamski, 808 State, James Buckley, Kate Thornton, Dom Jolly, Suede. There's a huge back catalogue. James Lavelle from Uncle. So go and have an explore in the back catalogue if you've just headed over to this podcast for the first time, and hopefully you'll find some other stuff in the back catalogue that you like. And if that's not enough, then I also have a Patreon page that supports this podcast, and I put a standalone episode out each week over there. The best way to find out about all of these things is offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Okay. Back to today's episode. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Dead Lee of Sheep on Drugs. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. and they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we're recording. We are in the centre of Hipsterville in East London. And sitting opposite me today is he's Dead Lee from Sheep on Drugs.
Indeed.
You all right?
Yeah, good, thanks, yeah.
Thanks for giving up your time and coming in and having a chat. We've had a brief chat. We've never met before. Yeah. Well, we have met, I guess. You'd never remember it, but you did come out to Essex and play my venue. Probably, I reckon, mid-90s that would have been.
Right, yes.
And and so yeah, I'm not expecting you to remember me. Someone did. My first memory of that night was somebody, it was either yours or Duncan, had a gun.
Oh, yeah, Duncan, yeah.
And someone nicked his gun that night.
Yes.
And he was very unhappy about that.
Yeah, he got it back.
He did. But there was, yeah, he was really not impressed with that. All right, well, when we start this podcast, we always start with track one, which is the song with the greatest ever intro.
Yeah, well, that's quite a tough question, actually. And I was thinking of loads of different tracks, some musical intros, blah, blah. But then I did think of this song, and I thought it's the perfect intro because it tells you the story of the song before it started.
Yeah. And that track is?
Is, it's Leader of the Pack by Shangri-La. Yeah.
You're the second person in 2 weeks to choose that.
Wow.
And it would probably be mine as well.
Right.
It's, and I was saying as well, when a former guest picked that as well, like, no one talks in records anymore, do they?
No.
And it's such a great thing. Shangri-La's done it incredibly anyway, but just that kind of concept of just, it's storytelling, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's wonderful. And then kind of starts with the revving of a motorbike as well.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah, sound effects and a story. Can't
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So going back to the sort of the formation of Sheep on Drugs and the early years of that, what was, I mean, I guess it kind of formed, would have been early 90s, is that correct?
Yes, yeah, I met Duncan in 89, September 89.
Yeah.
And we'd formed a band within the year, kind of thing. Not that we knew exactly how to do it.
Yeah.
Because Duncan didn't do any singing at that point. He'd done a bit of performance art, and I, you know, got some machines. I was sick of working with musicians because they always let you down, didn't turn up to rehearsals, etc. So I thought I'll get some machines, and then met Duncan, got on with him really well, and he had some good ideas. And because he was kind of had a little notebook and was always jotting down things, I thought, oh, maybe you could be the vocalist or something, or come up with some words anyway. But anyway, we started, and he didn't actually do any singing initially. We played The Brain, like this tiny club in middle of London. I think it was Wardour Street, somewhere around there. And he just performed, you know, like mimed, kind of, if you like. Really full on stuff to have the nerve to do that.
Yeah.
And then we did less than, actually, it was less than 10 gigs we did before we got signed, which was
can I ask what sort of environment them gigs were in? Because if we're talking 89, are we talking the kind of acid happened?
Well, yes.
And is it so kind of, was techno kind of starting to form and was...
our first couple of gigs were, around 89, which were just try out things, really. We got our formula of the kind of techno beats with... a bit of vocal idea, but there wasn't initially anywhere. It was like our first record company that suggested that Duncan do some vocals. So it was, but it was his performance was his ability really.
Yeah.
So it was rapid the formation and how it went. You know?
Was there influences from what was also happening with some of the stuff on Mute at the late 80s? Some of the kind of the industrial stuff that was coming across into, and starting to sort of break out in the UK as well.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I was impressed with acid house. That really got me. That it was like, a new kind of music. I mean, very anonymous initially, and we were kind of wanting to fit in with that groove. But you can't really be anonymous and a band because people need to know who you are.
Yeah,
yeah. So, it was acid house was the real inspiration, and those kind of machines that were making that stuff. But in our own secluded little world that we were in, we were imagining how this new music would be performed live. What the bands would look like. Of course, there were no bands, but we were projecting in our alternative universe what these people would be like making this music, and that's what we attempted to do.
Okay, well, we'll pick back up on that as we work through this. But I want to know, Lee, what the first song was that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about this, and I think that probably all songs that I heard from birth had an emotional impact on me.
Sure.
So it's about what I can remember.
Yeah.
And I do remember the moon landings on a little black and white telly. And I kind of remember that song around a similar time. So, and it definitely had an impact on me, So I would say that was David Bowie's Space Oddity.
My emotion would have been what?
I want to be a spaceman.
Have you made it into space yet?
In a way, yes.
Outside of your own mind, like. Yeah. We've all been there. So where was you born?
I was born in Oakham in Rutland.
Okay. Where's that, Lee?
Exactly. I was born there and moved when I was two, so I don't remember anything about that. That's Rutland is the smallest county in England, I believe. So there's something kind of special about it.
Yeah.
But I don't really know much about it.
And you moved to where at two?
I moved to Morecambe in Lancashire when I was two until I was about 16, and then moved from Morecambe to Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire to do my A-levels kind of thing, and then moved to London to university after that and stayed in London.
Okay, well let's go back to probably the second place that you recall.
Yeah, more
staying in, which leads on to track three, which is a song that reminds you of your time at school.
Yes, well, this song it was happening the sort of new romantics, I guess you'd call
definitely.
At that time, Japan were like, Quiet Life was a song that reminded me of school because it was happening around that time. And what I liked about Japan was that they were reluctant pop stars, if you like, which I thought was a totally mad concept in itself. How can you be recluse and be a pop star at the same time?
They certainly, well, he certainly wasn't Simon Le Bon, was he?
No, exactly. And it was, so it was a good, Japan had it all round good package, I thought, with Mick Kahn on the bass, which... don't know if you ever saw them, but it was like he was moving on rails. you know, right. when he was playing his bass, he's doing like a little ballet kind of
what, step. Like, sort of like Wilco?
Like Wilco.
Right.
Yes, in the kind of gliding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is great.
It looks incredible.
It does, yeah.
I mean, at that point, you know, seeing Japan, I mean, he was a beautiful human being to look at, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Was you drawn to something more colourful and interesting and maybe alternative than Duran Duran, say?
Oh, yeah. Duran Duran were too mainstream, really. You know, I never really liked the mainstream. There's always alternative things that I got into. Because, I mean, the charts have been fairly crap forever, really, even when there was a kind of chart.
Yeah.
You were lucky if there was a couple of tracks in the top 40 that were any good.
Yeah.
So it was always I was always looking outside of that. And, just so happened that Japan particularly, and then after Japan was more the kind of goth thing arrived.
Yeah.
Which I was into, like Alien Sex Fiend as well, which was good. So, yeah, but it was always out of the mainstream that I was impressed by.
Why do you think that was?
That's a tricky question. Because the... I think the music in the charts is shallower, if you like.
Yep.
It's just kind of glossy, good time, shallow.
Yeah.
There's nothing deep to it. And... outside of the mainstream, you can actually have some bit of depth. The art can be a bit deeper, which that's what I prefer.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's more interesting over there.
Yeah,
I think it's, for me, personally, I remember probably in the sort of mid-80s being exposed to lots of kind of pop music. Any young child is, but still seeing things like Depeche Mode and Nitzer Ebb and thinking, that's a bit more interesting.
That's
a little darker. And they dress a little bit more interestingly than these guys. And I think it's definitely a choice, I think, that you make. If you're excited and drawn to music and art and substance.
Yeah.
I think that more alternative path is a natural way to gravitate to. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's much more fertile, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. Okay, so how was school, Lee?
Morecambe growing up there was a bit grim, really, because it's like raining all the time, as far as I remember, anyway.
Yeah.
And everything was a bit normal there. I couldn't wait to escape, in a way, from that. What was the question again?
How was school?
Oh, how was school? Yeah, it was. I was reasonably bright, so so I could show off by being clever, which was what I did for a while.
Were you creative?
No, I wasn't actually. I wasn't in like music classes at school. Was never encouraged to get on, and was told to kind of shut up. Really, you know. But that's kind of school music systems, which are geared towards classical music anyway.
Yeah.
I don't even know if today you can get proper music courses to make music in a non-classical way. You know?
Well, I want to pick back up on something that you said earlier then about the sort of formation of Sheep on Drugs and, you know, coming from the tail end of Acid House. Because for me, I think that the fundamental ethic of Acid House and you know, is punk as fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, look, I can afford this basic piece of equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
What racket can I make with it?
Yes.
And that's punk, right? Well, it hasn't got to be three chords and guitars to be punk. And I think the whole kind of thing with Acid House was people with a 303 or whatever it was,
yeah.
making new music.
Yes, new music.
Yeah.
That's the operative thing, yeah.
And so what did you have at your disposal when this started to happen? What was you, was it a couple of synths? Was you playing guitar?
What I did was I started off with guitar because it was the most immediate thing that you could make with a fuzz pedal. You could make a racket without being able to play anything. So that appealed to me initially. I thought feedback sounds quite good by itself. So yeah. The guitar, electric guitar with the fuzz pedal was the first thing I got. And then the next thing I got was a sampler. So I was basically, I bought, when they first came out, you could buy little, well, toys, I guess they were, like a couple of octaves on little keys, like a little keyboard, but and had one sample in it, like a second sample.
Yeah.
And I got into using that, which was... It couldn't even store the samples. You had to sample it live every time. But it was mind-blowing. And I'd seen it on Tomorrow's World a while earlier, the sampler, and it had always impressed me, grabbing a sound and then being able to use it as an instrument. And unfortunately, that little toy that I had, which I was getting on so well, we got nicked. And then I thought, I've got to get a proper sampler.
Yeah.
So around the time I met Duncan... was when I had a job for a while where getting the money to get together to get a sampler, which was a sampling keyboard at the time. I got the first thing with a sequencer and then quickly followed by a drum machine. So it was all cobbled together quite quickly over the period I met Duncan, and we borrowed a grand or something off his dad to buy a few bits and pieces.
Yeah.
And we didn't need to do any more than that.
Yeah.
And before you knew it, we were being offered a S-1000 to help us, for our first record deal.
So, all right, well, I'll pick back up on then when you got signed and what happened from there after the next track then. So for track 4, Lee, can you tell me the first song you remember buying from a record shop?
That was the first vinyl I remember... picking up was Blockbuster by Sweet.
Yeah,
it's kind of what I liked about it. Well, another one was Sound Effects in it, and what I particularly liked about that there was the beat, the kind of floor tom, enhanced beat, it was just a bit mad as well,
Did you like glam?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's dressing up, isn't it?
Yeah. Was that something as the band sort of formed, that visual was very important?
Oh yeah. Well, we knew that visual is half the battle. Really.
Yeah. As somebody that was a fan of Sheep on Drugs, I remember. For those that are listening that aren't overly familiar with Lee and Duncan's work, it's quite an abrasive sound, I think, and I mean that with the greatest of respect.
Yeah.
But visually, I found Sheep on Drugs gigs unsettling.
Yeah.
And when you joined the mailing list, correct me if I'm wrong, you sent out a sweet.
Yes.
And it said something like, do not eat this.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Or eat this and you are ours.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't fucking eat that. And it was... because I just weren't convinced. I was just thinking, I don't fucking trust these guys. It felt different from everything else that was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like... yeah, that band's fucked up. And I hope that's what you were setting out to do.
Yes,
because
indeed.
It worked.
Yeah,
It was unnerving, it was unsettling, and it was exciting.
Yes, good.
And that's what I wanted from a live gig.
Yes.
And that's what you've done every time I see you. It was like, holy shit, this is crackers.
And good.
Just the fact that Duncan will walk on stage with a blank firing gun.
Mm.
And if you ever want to get an audience's attention, fire one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's deafening.
Yes.
And if you want to unsettle your audience, that's how you do it.
Yes.
And from that moment, you know, we was partying your hands. All right, so going back to record shops now. Were they an important place for you growing up?
Yeah, very important place. I spent, many a Saturday afternoon flicking through records. And another thing that's all relating to the visual thing, like the visuals on the record cover are so important too.
Yeah.
I can remember buying records just on for the cover and being surprised by, you know, that it was... happily surprised that it was good music.
So, what like?
I think that I bought the Velvet Underground Banana record on the strength of the cover, yeah. So, I love that album. So, that was one that I can think of. Can't particularly think of it. Having thought of that, I can't think of any other album.
But I was DJing at a venue in Birmingham a couple of years ago, and this relates to you and your album, your record artwork. Mm. And I was chatting to this lad who was looking after the DJs and the bands and stuff, and smashing fella he was, got chatting away. And for some reason we got talking about early 90s and the stuff that we was listening to. And yeah, I said, into this band called Sheep on Drugs. And he said, yeah, I was involved. He said, I worked for their fan club or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, and I'm on the cover.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just thought, God, what me and my mates would have given, because on the cover for 15 Minutes of Fame,
yes.
It was all little Polaroid pictures, wasn't it?
Yes.
All like the passport photos of the old fan club members.
Well, yeah, we basically said, send £2 and two passport photos to join the fan club, although it's probably worded better than that. But we'll make you famous, that was it.
Yeah.
So, and we just managed to get enough to cover the 12-inch when we really had to release it.
And that was it. This guy was on there. I was like, oh, my God, you're on the cut. He said, yeah, I'm one of them. I was like, oh, that's brilliant. I just remember, like, just the you know, would you say that's your logo? The syringes and it's, again, it's like, it just felt like a cult.
Yes.
And and I'm not trying to pay lip service here. That's how it felt to me and a lot of my friends, that, you know, you looked at it, it ticked every box. It was like, it sounded strange and interesting, and it looked strange and interesting. And then when you start getting sent sweets in the post, it was too strange and interesting for me to eat. Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track podcast, and you can listen to all.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
the songs, because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. Okay, so moving forward, I want to know for track five, Lee, the song that soundtracked your years in Clubland.
Oh, yeah, that was, what was it called?
The Modern Lovers.
Modern Lovers, a Roadrunner. Yeah. That was, this was before the Acid House thing kind of happened. So it was like, I guess you'd call it alternative club music. And that was one that seemed to always be on. Which is a classic.
It's a great record.
Great record, yeah. Sorry, go on.
Where would clubbing be?
I was living in... I went to Goldsmiths College for a short period, and so I was living in New Cross and went to the venue in New Cross, yeah.
Which we did touch on earlier, which is one of the many places I saw you use a lot.
Yes, yeah, which was a great venue to play. A sprung dance floor, which was great. Shame they don't put bands on anymore in there.
So what sort of stuff was being played in them sort of clubs that win the venue at that sort of time?
It was as I say, it was alternative kind of things like Sisters of Mercy and Velvet Underground and kind of,
so is this what, 86, 87,
something like that? About that time. Yeah, just before the Acid House kind of kicked off.
And that's a strange kind of period in music, that, I think. It's like, it feels like, when I look back, I'm just a little bit too young to kind of been clubbing then, but it almost feels that 86, 87 was a very strange time in music where it felt like lots of the exciting stuff that had happened in electronic music in the earlier parts of the 80s and some of the exciting stuff that was happening with guitars, kind of, maybe with the exception of like the Smiths and things like that, maybe The Cure, but then it felt like there was a need for something.
That's it.
And that 88 saw, I guess, the evolution of acid house and rave culture and hip-hop.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it just felt like you was just slapped around the chops with all of these kind of new sounds.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I say that with as much love for what I was hearing in hip-hop, which was, again, I guess, a 303 or, whatever it was.
909.
909. Yeah. And again, punk as fuck.
Yes.
Just doing it themselves with these little drum machines and rapping is the same as what was happening in Acid House.
Yes.
And, like, so when that happened, Acid House, was that something that just really, really got to you?
Yeah, it totally, it was, what I liked about it, it was, sometimes it was like dubious whether you could actually call it music, you know. Yeah. It was like this thumping beat with a weird squiggly synth on there.
Sure.
Which I was, it was mind-blowing. It was like, wow, this is proper new music.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't sound like anything I've heard before.
Yeah.
And that's what was inspiring about it, the fact that these people had cobbled together a sound that was new. And the fact that it was new inspired me. And I think today, for example, bands are so boring because with today's technology, you can literally make new sounds all the time. And people are very sort of timid in progression, you know. I would have thought that by now music would be really strong. I mean, dubstep kind of started going towards that that thing. But it's very slow, the progression, you know.
But I think in this day and age now, I think dubstep being a prime example of something that's fundamentally very London sounding and very, very British sounding, that was done with minimal software and then just created something. And then the minute that the powers that be see that there's a market, they swamp it.
Yes.
And then before you know it, Madonna's getting dubstep remixes. Yes. And then, like, and then you can't maintain that kind of excitement and underground. And obviously with acid house and rave culture, it wasn't even the the major labels getting hold of it. I guess the Criminal Justice Act got bought in, and and it was like, well, hang on a minute, too many people are being nice to each other in a field. Let's stop this. Which is fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
So to go back to 10 gigs in, you get offered a record deal.
Yeah, less than 10 gigs, yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, it's amazing. I don't really know. Like, what we did, we started off, we thought, right, we're a band, we need to play to captive audiences. You know, we thought about playing pubs and stuff and thought, no, that's not the... We need to pick a place in the middle of London. There's a little club that people are paying to get in anyway.
Yeah.
They're not going to go if we play our set. They're captive. We've got them.
Yeah.
And we were, the only place that would let us play was this Brain Club. And what we did, Duncan, we knew the guy, Sean McCluskey, that was putting it on.
Right.
Yeah, right. And so Duncan would be able to get into the club a bit earlier in the afternoon. And he would do things like put scaffolding pole from the... to make like a stage area.
Yeah.
Because there was no stage. So we'd kind of fence off a bit and put some plastic around it with latex on it so it was all glowing in the UV light, and kind of cut his way out of it. And had, as I say, we played a gig a month for about six or something like that, six or seven times, I think. And then we got a gig in the Milk Bar, which we did. We did it in, we couldn't get there early, but we got up on stage, did our little show, and they stopped it halfway through. There was like a little break and... before the next sample where it went in, and they cut it off. And it was like, so we hadn't even played our full set. We came off stage feeling a bit pissed off. This guy came up to me who turned out to be Paul Glancy from Rhythm King Records, and he just said, have you got a record deal? And I said, no, but we want to get one. And he said, oh, well, here's my details, send your tape into this. And it was like, whoa, I thought that happened in films.
Yeah. Right? That was easy.
Yes. And so anyway, we sent the cassette to them, our demo. They didn't like it, so they said, we'll put you in a studio, and put us in like a little studio. For several times, it seemed like they were never happy, but they put us in a few times, and we came out with Drug Music, was the first track, and then, you know, I think Catch 22 or something like that. But it was very rapid. It's basically from, as I say, we hadn't done 10 gigs.
Yeah.
You know, we got, somebody said, do you want a record deal? Yeah. And then it was a period of waiting. Well, and we met, the other thing, the funny thing is we met our manager at the time through Duncan's girlfriend at the time.
Yeah.
And he was perfect for us. He steamed in. He helped us with the lawyer, etc.
Yeah.
Sort out the record deal, which would have been a nightmare otherwise, because you need a lawyer. In fact, you need someone with the right head to go through it.
Yeah.
Especially back then when
it was
you know, more in depth and there was more money to be made. So we had this manager which leaned on them. So 6 months later, after being offered the deal, we get signed with our first record deal. And that, so that was like September 91. And then before you know it, we're on Island Records.
How was that? How did that feel?
It felt proof of what we were saying, that we should have been on a major label.
Yeah.
But still, it's quite hard to believe that we actually got there, though, you know.
Yeah.
Because it was like Chris Blackwell, he was the one that signed us.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
He came
along and saw us, because our manager had worked from before and kind of half knew him a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, he came to one of our gigs. I can't remember where, one of the, possibly even the one in New Cross, even that kind of size gig. He came along and then, we were signed.
And
it's like a rapid.
Yeah. I mean, did you feel like you were prepared for it?
No.
That made it all the better,
Well, it was like being on a roller coaster. and then bits start flying off.
Yeah.
You know, we were hurtling forward.
Yeah.
We thought it would take quite a while to get things to get, you know, get signed. Suddenly we were signed, and yeah, it was like we're rocketing and the bits are falling off.
Yeah. Did you get put out with any other bands to tour or anything like that? Did you support any
bands?
Well,
the other thing, the other funny, lucky thing that happened is the first tour we did was supporting Daisy Chainsaw, which they just had their hit.
Love You, Mate.
Number one hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And somehow, somebody that they knew had seen some of our gigs in the Brain.
Yeah.
And put us together.
Yeah.
So suddenly, we're on
There's
tour
two
with
absolutely
a number
insane bands back to back.
Yes, exactly. And they, the great thing is, they just had a number one, so there's loads of people.
Yeah.
And we were like blowing off stage every night.
Yeah. Yeah, shit. I mean, I saw Daisy Chainsaw again at the Pink Toothbrush.
Mm. Oh, that's where I remember it from. Yeah. That tour. Yeah, yeah.
She was a force of nature.
Oh, yeah.
Like, crackers.
Yeah, crackers.
Like,
yeah.
But definitely great to watch live.
Mm.
And so, how did you find the kind of... How did you find being famous?
I enjoyed it. It was good. I mean, it was weird as well, you know. It was weird. You know, our egos inflated massively once being signed. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you look back on it and you think, oh yeah, it did sort of make me a bit worse as a person. But,
yeah.
The worst thing, it's easy getting used to being famous, is when it suddenly,
suddenly
you're not on Island Records anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, fuck, who am I, you know?
Yeah.
So it's surviving the other thing that is the thing that makes you, really, you know.
And to call your album Greatest Hits,
yeah.
I mean, that's fucking cool.
Yeah.
That's so fucking cool. All right, track six, Lee. A favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Yeah, well, I consider London to be my home county.
Okay.
So I picked another, what I would consider a London band, the Sex Pistols, and Holidays in the Sun.
So, was you old enough to appreciate punk?
As a child, yeah. I mean, I noticed it, but I was too young to be a punk, you know. That's where I latched onto the next thing with the first incarnation of electronic music with the New Romantics or whatever you want to call them at that time. So, yeah, but still liked the vibe of punk and also considered that to be kind of punk too, with all these blokes with makeup.
Completely.
And, yeah, sort of another kind of form of punk. So, the two, for me, the two go together, and the punk thing is still going, you know.
When you was young and you'd see, you know, Lydon on TV or in the papers, like, was it, as a kid, was it exciting? Was it scary?
What? Yeah, a bit scary and exciting. Scary and exciting, yeah.
It's hilarious when you look back at it now with, you know, with a 2020 mind now.
Yeah.
And you look back and you see the furore.
Yes.
At the Pistols.
Yeah, yeah.
It almost seems ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
When you look back and you go, they were just moaning, with great music.
Yes.
You know, but...
Society was scared.
It was. And I mean, that's great though, isn't it? And it's like, will that happen again? I don't know. Will grime do that? I don't, I obviously rave culture done it. Society didn't know. The Beastie Boys done it, like, all of these things, you know, you fucking done it. You scared me, mate.
Yes, well, we're still trying to scare people.
Right, well, let's talk about that then. So, Duncan, he's now sort of occasionally plays with you, and
no, he hasn't played since I think it's 1998 was the last gig Duncan did. He got it lost its appeal to him. You know, we'd gone into see what happened. We got rapidly signed. So we went from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds or whatever. Sure. And then we were on the major. Then we didn't actually get dropped from Ireland. PolyGram bought Ireland and let every band that hadn't recouped at that point, got rid of them.
Yeah.
We'd just had a top 40 hit.
Yeah.
You know, I wish they'd fucking thought about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were out of a job, so we started working with Martin Atkins in Invisible Records, which was a totally different kettle of fish. We suddenly went from doing, having done 9 gigs and getting, signed to a point where we were on a transit van touring around the States for 2 months, which we'd never been on a transit van before. It'd been a tour bus always.
Yeah.
And kind of the shine had really gone off it at that point. And it was hellish. The tour was hellish. So after that point, and also the bad treatment from Invisible Records, it lost its appeal to Duncan. And then he just didn't want to do it. And now that he hasn't done it for so long, he couldn't do it. He's lost his kind of nerve, if you like, his stage sort of presence. So he's now a tattooist.
Yeah.
So
very well respected tattooist as well, isn't indeed, he? Yeah, from what I'm told.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, he's a respected tattooist. Yeah. So so I understood that he didn't want to do it, which, I understood why he didn't want to do it. Also, he felt that he was never really a singer. He felt a bit worried about his voice, for some reason.
Really?
Yes. It was stupid, really. But it was a paranoia, thinking, I don't know how to sing kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that was rubbish, really. Of course he did. But suddenly, then I haven't got a bandmate. So I did some solo stuff, Bagman, which is kind of drum and bass without a vocalist on it, which was because I didn't have one, so I thought I'd do that.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, so I did a couple of those albums, and a few years later I think it was 2002, got offered a few gigs for like $2,000 a piece, I think it's 3 gigs, $2,000 a piece, and it's like, whoa, $6,000, and so said to Duncan, do you want to do it? Three gigs, and he said, even if you offered me 10 times that amount, I wouldn't do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I thought, oh, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
But I wanted to do them. So anyway, first of all, I thought, I can't do it. How can I do it? And then the promoter said, why can't you do it yourself? Kind of made my head whir a bit. And I thought, oh, okay. Got a guitarist in to help and did the vocals myself. Which I wasn't totally happy with doing that. It's a much harder job being a front man. But anyway, did it for a while. And tried a few, like a couple of other people in the band, didn't really work out. And then I think it was 2005. I think I met Johnny, and she's perfect for the role.
Where did you meet her?
I think it was. I'm not quite sure where I'm at. I think in some nightclub actually, through friends of a friend of a friend kind of thing.
Yeah.
First met her, and then I think she came and helped do merchandise for a Sheep on Drugs gig.
Right.
And I met her a bit more. And then got rid of the other person and then basically tried her out. And the good thing is she's a keyboardist anyway. So started her off playing samples to kind of get her into the Sheep on Drugs mode, if you like.
Sure.
And then as we progressed and started writing songs together, sort of brought her more forward to do the vocals, which I prefer.
Yeah.
Because there's enough to do otherwise without doing the vocals.
Of course,
keeping the machines on track.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about the bits you got coming up in a moment. But for track 7, a song that many may not know.
Yeah.
That you would like them to hear.
Yeah, that one's Women of the World by Ivor Butler.
Okay.
And it's a simple song. Well, I'll let the song do the talking, really. But it's basically about, it's going, women of the world take over. you know, because if you don't, the world will come to an end, and we haven't got long. You know, basically, wars are happening all the time. You know, I think that we should, this paternal society is not working out that well, you know. Maybe we should give it a go for women to do stuff, you know.
How did you discover that?
I don't know, actually. That's a difficult one. I think it might have initially heard some Ivor Butler on the radio or something like that, and then investigated it, and that was one that particularly stood out.
Okay. So, gigs, what's happening?
Well, we've got a couple of gigs, well, three gigs at the moment actually lined up. We've got one in Paper Dress, I believe is the name of the venue, in Hackney. Mm-hmm. That's on the 3rd of March. We've got one in Brighton, the Prince Albert, on the 8th of March. That's all we've got booked at the moment, but we're looking to book some more gigs, so we'll keep that going. And we've got a gig in a festival in Madrid, in which is called Dark Mad Fist Festival, which I thought is quite a good name. And that's in October the 23rd and 24th, I believe that's one.
And new music?
New music, yeah, we're cracking on with a new album. The songs are embryonic at the moment, but there's a good few of them bubbling under.
Yeah.
We're in the studio. Well, we just have regular studio sessions booked to keep recording. Yeah. And we've done a version of a cover. We found another cover song to do, and it's we've done a cover of Downtown.
Tudor Clark.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So where's the best place if people want to keep up to speed on Sheep on Drugs?
Well, the website's always there, sheepondrugs.net. Facebook, we put our stuff on the website, Facebook. Instagram, I need to keep up a bit more, but yeah, we're on Instagram as well. Between those places.
Wonderful. Well, if you're comfortable for me to tag all of those in it when we put this out, then people can go and find and investigate further.
Yes, brilliant.
Nice. Lovely. One. Lee, thanks loads, mate.
Yeah, my pleasure.
There you go. That was Lee. Deadly. He wasn't dead, and he certainly wasn't deadly either. He was super kind, right? It was a lovely chat, and really, really pleased that he gave up his time. And it was nice to find out, you know, a peek behind the curtain of something that, you know, unnerved me as a teen at these Sheep on Drugs gigs. And an absolute gentleman. Like I say at the beginning, please go and explore the back catalogue. The best thing you can do is subscribe to this. That's always nice if you can do that. And if you see us on the socials, please give us a like, love, share, retweet and all that jazz. Thanks ever so much for listening. Thanks again to Lee for popping in and recording this. And I will see you next week. Have a lovely time. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. PodBibleMag.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Beautiful.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.